Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa.Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last day of 2019, as I'm sure everybody here is aware. And it's very lovely to see such a large gathering of people coming together to end the year in a wholesome and auspicious way. Common customs for many, many people is to be partying the night away on this day. Having been a party animal myself in previous years, I can relate to that kind of spirit or that intention. But I feel it's something that is more beneficial to ourselves and to the people around us and to the world in general, that we choose to celebrate the completion of a year and the beginning of a new year with coming together to reflect upon what is wholesome and beneficial for us, and to also take the time to consider and to set the intentions for the direction for the future, to set our goals or our resolutions for the coming year. I've often led meditation retreats on the theme of dying and death and preparing for death and such like. And I just led such an event in Thailand, a week-long retreat on aging and dying in the Chiang Mai area. And during these retreats, one of the kinds of practice that I like to introduce and to have people engaging in is what I call a death rehearsal. So we won't do that this evening, necessarily. But it's a way of reflecting upon the ending of things. And this was a focus for spiritual practice, for meditation, that the Buddha encouraged very strongly. He emphasized that it's really useful, very beneficial for us as human beings to reflect upon the actuality, the inevitability of physical death, and to bring that to mind on a daily basis, to recollect, I'm of the nature to age, I'm of the nature to sicken, I'm of the nature to die, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So from a position of the ego and of self-centered thinking, that sounds like a disaster. It's like a really depressing and unpleasant things to be thinking of. But the Buddha encouraged us to look at the way that life works and to see that the things that integrate inevitably disintegrate, and things come together. Necessarily, they come apart. Anything that begins ends. What goes up must come down. And what gets born must eventually die one day. So the Buddha was encouraging us to be realistic and to bring our hearts into alignment, to bring our hearts into tune with the reality of nature. In these retreats, what I call the death rehearsal, it's a way of imagining, say, when you sit down at the beginning of this meditation period, or you can do it lying down. I have conducted this a few times here in the temple with people lying down on the floor of the temple, you know, women on one side, men on the other side. And the basic format is that you consider this is the last 45 minutes of your life. And when the bell goes at the end, then that is the time of the last breath, and your life is over. So it's a period of time to consider, okay, my life is coming to an end. What's important? What has value? What is useful to bring to mind, to put our attention on, and to, if we've only got 45 minutes, 40 minutes, half an hour left of our life, what is useful? What's going to be beneficial to look at? So I feel at the ending of a year, it's kind of like a death rehearsal. 2019 is about to die. It's got another 3 hours and 20 minutes left to go. It's nearly at the end of its cycle. And so if our life was going to end at midnight tonight, I'm not making any predictions, just in case you're getting worried. But if our life was going to end, if our last breath came at midnight tonight, what would be useful to focus upon? You know, where's the best party happening? Yeah. Where's the biggest supply of free booze? Yeah. Where's the best music playing? Yeah. Where are all my most exciting and interesting friends? Or what are the things to be focusing upon? So the way I like to lead this kind of meditation, I thought I would share this evening, as I feel that these are useful considerations to bring to mind. So essentially, that there's four themes to contemplate that seem to be most useful. So as the year comes to an end, or if our life was coming to an end, you know, first of all, if you've only got a little while left of this life, it's good to look at all of the grudges that you have, the feelings of resentment or negativity towards other people, either in your family, people close to you, people in the society, political leaders it might have been, or your school teachers from your primary school who were horrible to you. You've never recovered from the way Miss Rogers talked to you, and you know, back in class 2 at primary school. Actually, she was very nice, if I remember correctly. But if you have that sense of negativity, what they call patika in Pali, a kind of resentment, a grudge. Whenever you think of that person's name, there's a sort of, yeah, and then they're like this, they did that. And then someone who's hurt you, who's harmed you, and that you carry around with a negative perception. So the encouragement is to bring such people to mind. And you're not trying to pretend that they didn't hurt you, or you haven't still got the scars from the way they affected you, either physical scars or mental scars. But rather, if you've only got a few minutes or a couple of hours left of your life, do you want to be carrying them around? Do you still want to harbor that negativity, that bitterness in your heart? And again, this was something that the Buddha pointed to many, many times, particularly in the Dhammapada, where he said, hatred is never conquered by hatred. Hatred is only ever conquered by love. This is a law ancient and inexhaustible. This is the ancient law. So that is a useful exercise, I would suggest, because this evening, the format for this evening is we have a Dhamma talk now, and then this will go on for about an hour altogether. We'll see. And then after that, people are welcome invited to carry on with the meditation, sitting, walking meditation, to stay here for the evening. And then at 11:30, the Sangha will be chanting the Paritta, the protective blessing verses. to invite the auspicious forces of the universe to gather and to be, empowering our lives, our hearts, our minds. And that is the way that we bring the new year in. And in the meditation, also we encourage people to be practicing loving kindness and to be spreading that sentiment, that attitude around the world. So if we only have a couple of hours or so to be living, this is the end of the cycle, then do we want to be carrying around that person who hurt us, a parent who let us down, or someone who cheated us or lied to us or harmed us, who took advantage of us, who treated us badly? And in the spirit of loving kindness, we're not trying to pretend that the bitter is sweet. We're not trying to pretend that the scars are not really there. But rather, do we have to project hatred? Do we have to sustain that quality of aversion in our heart? Or can we forgive? And it's also notable that the word give is there in the word forgiveness. That's not an accident. Forgiveness is a giving. You're giving space to other people to not be perfect. Yeah. Oftentimes, people come and ask for advice. They have struggles and difficulties in their lives. They've been hurt by their parents, or their spouse has broken up with them or left them, or they've been fired from a job, and they have a lot of bitterness and resentment, or how people have lied to them or cheated them or been cruel to them. And the people will say, well, how can they do this? How could my mother have treated me that way? How could this man I walked down the aisle with at the church that we got married, how could he treat me this way? How could he be so dishonest and cheat on me and be so awful? And I try not to be unsympathetic, but what we often do is we are assuming that people will behave like arahants, that everyone will behave like an enlightened being, that all the people in our lives, in our family, in the workplace, in our schools, in our government, as if they were incapable of being dishonest, if they were all completely unselfish, they were all kind, compassionate, generous, and completely benevolent. But people aren't that way. The number of arahants, totally enlightened beings in the world, is very, very few. And the number of non-arahants is very great. So most of the people around us are guided by greed, hatred, and delusion a lot of the time. And so one of the things that I point out to people is that in Buddhism, we have a different measure for sanity than you do in Western psychology. So that, say, in Western psychology, for example, Sigmund Freud said, the best that my method can do is to transform your neurotic misery into ordinary human unhappiness. So that's like the top of the scale is ordinary human unhappiness in terms of Freudian psychology. This is a rough outline. But in Buddhist psychology, we would say, rather than just aiming for ordinary human unhappiness, that's kind of where we start. You begin with ordinary human unhappiness, and then you evolve beyond that. And within the Buddhist perspective of psychology, sanity or human sort of full human integration only comes with full enlightenment. So essentially, what that means is that everyone who is not enlightened is crazy to a degree. So this is like life in the psychiatric ward. So we are living with our fellow patients in the psych ward. Some of us are dressed in white, you know, conveniently colored in this way. And again, I'm not trying to make light of this just make a joke of it, but rather, if we consider that this is like life in the psychiatric ward, we can become a lot more accommodating and, say, generous to the people, the fellow patients. You know, if rather than thinking that your family, your mother and your father and your your wife or your husband or your bosses in the workplace or your school teachers, your university lecturers and so on, that rather than thinking they should all be perfectly enlightened, unselfish, kind, generous, warm-hearted and helpful beings, that they are fellow patients on the psychiatric ward, then if we change our perspective in that way, we find we can be a lot more forgiving. We find that when we allow people to make mistakes. And when we look at it in that way, it's like, well, of course, yeah, my parents, they weren't totally enlightened beings. Of course, some of the things they did were selfish or were emotionally reactive, or they were unthoughtful, they were unkind. They didn't know what to do. They weren't that wise. They weren't that skilled or that pure-hearted. Of course, why should they be? So when we look at those feelings of resentment in our heart, again, we're not pretending that that pain is not there, but rather we find that we can forgive. We can allow people to not be perfect. We can allow other people to have made mistakes. We're not glad that they made mistakes or they treated us or others in harmful ways, but we recognize that's the way life is. And so why carry that around? People make mistakes. People's judgment is not perfect, of course. It is necessarily that way. And so then we can let go. We can, free the heart from that kind of burden. It's like a heavy weight that we're carrying around unnecessarily, and we find we can put that down. So the second contemplation that I like to encourage as the time ticks away in that meditation. And usually I say the meditation might be 45 minutes, it might be 40 minutes, it might be half an hour, it might be 50 minutes. You don't know when the last bell is going to go, when our life comes to an end. But the second contemplation then is to bring to mind what we can be grateful for. Reflecting upon the people in our lives, again, our parents, our loved ones, our sisters, our brothers, the people that we've married, the people who we've, say, had as our teachers, spiritual teachers, or people who, in our schools, or in university or college, or the workplace, people who have been inspiring, helpful, that we were really blessed to have known, that they were really incredibly helpful, that our lives would not have been as good as they have without that person's influence, because of that person's generosity, because of their kindness, because of their compassion, their thoughtfulness, then we have really been blessed. So to bring to mind, say now, as the year is coming to an end, in a similar way, say just during this year, who have blessed us in our families, not necessarily just our parents, it can be our children or others, other family members, grandchildren, their cousins and sisters and brothers, people in the workplace, people in the monastery, people on the road, sometimes an act of kindness by a complete stranger that you don't even know the name of can have a very powerful effect upon us. I often mention many years ago when I lived in California, they have often they have toll gates on bridges or on the motorways, and the way that it works is that if you have more than three people in a car, say for example, then you can get through the toll gate free. But there's one particular gate you have to go through, which is the toll-free gate. And as we were approaching the toll booths on the Oakland Bay Bridge, there's about 15 toll booths, that our driver suddenly realized, oh, we've got four people in the car. We can get through free. But we were over on the far left-hand side, and the free and the free booth was way over on the right. So she tried to cross about four or five, maybe six lanes of traffic to get to the free lane. And that caused a certain amount of negativity in other people that we were sharing the road with. And we didn't quite make it. She got across about five of the six lanes, or maybe four of the six lanes, before we got to the gates. And the people in the car behind us were kind of gesticulating, as they say. They were kind of making faces and shaking their fists and very upset and annoyed. So when we got to the toll booth, then our driver, I thought, with great skill and in an inspired move, she gave them twice the amount of money for the toll and said, this is for the car behind us as well. And so the people were still scowling and shaking their fists at us, and they got to the toll booth, and we were looking in the mirror as they got to the toll booth, and then the woman behind the counter said, oh, the car in front paid for you. And there was this kind of big smile, and then as we were driving across the Bay Bridge together, they're kind of waving and smiling and thumbs up. And so just we have no idea who those people were. I don't know their names. But that is that little act of kindness, a random gesture of friendliness, can be something that stays with us for a long time. Yeah, when you're tired and exhausted, and then you're on a crowded carriage of the London Underground, and somebody gets up and says, please, would you like a seat? And you go, wow, there are friendly, kind, thoughtful people in this world. Thank you. And that a gesture of kindness, of friendliness, that can restore our faith in human nature and can have a big impact upon us. So, as the year winds down this evening, I encourage that sense of looking through your world, also further into the past, and who are the people who have really helped us, and to cultivate that quality of gratitude. Not in terms of having a debt, that you owe that person something, that you owe your parents something, or you owe your teachers, or your ajans, or anybody that... you're not trying to create a feeling of, you know, I really should have repaid that. I really should do something in return. But rather, just that warmth of the heart that says, yeah, that my life was really blessed by being close to that person. They really helped. And to rejoice in the goodness that has been done. So in our Pali language that we use in our scriptures, in our chanting, there's a word anumodana, which literally means I rejoice in the good that has been done. So it's our way of saying thank you. Like, I'm really happy that you've made this good karma. It makes me joyful that you've done this this wholesome and beautiful, skillful act. So anumodana. And so that there can be a brightness of the heart that comes from that recognition of the blessings that we have had, not just, say, from people that are alive, but also just to really bring to mind the blessings of having lived in a time when the Buddha's teaching is in the world, and what the Buddha himself brought through his extraordinary skill and dedication, his incredible wisdom and purity of heart, and not only bringing his own heart and mind to a point of perfect self-realization, but then having the generosity, the kindness, the compassion to put his understanding into words and to find the ways that he did to teach so many thousands, millions of people, and that those teachings have been established in such a kind of thorough and skillful way that they're still alive and helpful to all of us today, 2,500 years later. Also, when I was in Sri Lanka recently, my first visit there, I was at meant to visit a place called the Alu Vihara, which is I think the Pali name for it is the Aloka Vihara. Aloka means light. These caves of light, and this is the place where the Pali canon, the scripture, our scriptures were first written down. So for the first 400 years after the Buddha's lifetime, and in the Buddha's lifetime, the teachings were always carried on by rote learning. So the teacher would sit down with the student, and they would recite the words of the teaching, say the suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, short middle-length discourses, the Dhammapada and so forth, and the rules of the Vinaya discipline and so forth. And the Buddha, in the Buddha's time, very, very few people had knowledge of writing and reading. It was used a little bit within business transactions and also with amongst Brahmin scholars, seemingly. And so the Buddha was quite keen, determined to make sure that the teachings didn't become owned by the few people who could read and write, but rather they were accessible to everybody. So whether you came from a poor farming family or you came from a rich Brahmin family, you had equal access to the teachings. So he had forbidden the teachings to be written down. And so that was the custom and the form. That's one of the reasons why the teachings are so repetitive, because it makes it easier to remember them as they just change one word in each paragraph, things like that. As we were reciting with the Dhammacakka Sutta, often you repeat the same pattern with just one or two words changing each time. So the caves of light were significant, and why the Pali Canon got written down was because at that time, this is about just over 2,000 years ago, about 73 before the Common Era, 73 years before the Common Era, there was war in Sri Lanka. It was called Tambapani in those days, the Copper Island. And the king, I think it was called Vatagamani, was in retreat, was hiding away, had been defeated by the invading armies from southern India, and was escaping from them. And also there was a famine. There was no food. There was a lot of people dying because of the war. The food supply was very, very small. So the feeling was, because a lot of the monks and nuns were dying and the ones who could remember the teachings, is the teachings are going to be lost. So many of the Sangha are dying. The king said, I have to make sure that these teachings, the kind of body of the religious knowledge, doesn't get lost, because all the people who can remember are dying. So we have to get this written down so it can be preserved. So he commanded them to ignore the Vinaya rule that the Buddha established, to say, you need to write this down. And so this group of Sangha members hid away in these caves, and under the king's command, they had to then put into writing on these ola leaf manuscripts the whole of the Pali Canon. And so that's, nowadays, that's about 42 fairly substantial books of teachings. And so this group of people, they're hiding away, they're being attacked by an invading army, they've got no food, and most of them can't read or write. Most of them can't read or write. They had to actually learn how to read and write to be able to get the teachings down. if you consider that, that's an extraordinary undertaking. And also they're starving. and they know that if they don't get this written down, the teachings could be lost altogether. So to me, just actually being in that place and getting a clearer picture of the story, how things unfolded, is amazing. And a sense of extraordinary gratitude, how incredible those people had the resolve, the energy, and also what it must have been like to be, carrying out that task in a war zone while you're starving. no pressure, and the teachings will be lost if you don't get this right. And then only a handful of people who knew the writing well, who could actually proofread it, say, no, that's a short A, not a long A. You know, you've done that wrong. Wrong accent, you know. And having to learn how to read and write in that process and succeeding. You know, that was a way that the teachings were preserved. And from that time, then they were written down, and they did survive and have come down to us today. So that feeling of people from that remote time, more than 2,000 years ago, they had that, the resolve, the energy, and the dedication to do that incredible job of getting the teachings recorded. And we're the beneficiaries. We inherit the results of that today. Like we chanted the Dhammacakka Sutta this evening. You know, not only would we not have those words to recite, but we wouldn't have the Vinaya discipline, the rules, the monastic order. We wouldn't have the teachings wouldn't have been there for those Ajahns who've been our teachers over these many centuries. It couldn't have come down to us. So none of this, Amaravati wouldn't be here if those people hadn't gathered in those caves and been scratching the letters onto the palm leaves through those nights. And they're called the Caves of Light because they had candles and lamps burning all night long. So it was like a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week project to try and get everything down before it disappeared. So when we think back of what we inherit, you know, we come here, maybe you visit Amaravati up this little lane in Hertfordshire. Oh, it's great. This is Buddhist center. It's a lovely monastery, great people, good food, you know, nice library, wonderful temple, very peaceful. And we kind of assume, well, it's here. You know, it's there for me and I enjoy it. Great. And we don't think, well, where did it come from? Or what are the roots that have, been the basis of this place? And if we look back, not only to the Buddha as a teacher, but also people like that group of Sangha members who got the teachings written down and preserved them for us, and then since that time, the many generations of practitioners in the monastic community, the lay community, generation after generation after generation for 25 centuries altogether, to bring it here, to Hertfordshire, to Amaravati, here at the end of 2019. It's amazing, incredible. So that sense of gratitude and delight, wow, marvelous, what an incredible inheritance to receive. And the third reflection I like to encourage is looking at our own actions, so particularly over the last year, but beyond that as well, to look at what we have said, what we have done, and as the minutes of our life are ticking away, it's now 9:05, so there's less than 3 hours to go now. So to look at the things of our life that we regret, things that we've done that were unkind or selfish or greedy, things that we did that were cruel or that caused harm to others, that were bad choices that we made that had negative impact on our own life or the lives of people around us. And again, not to just create a depressed or a sad feeling or to make ourselves feel, self-critical and negative, not to build up a sense of self-hatred, but rather just as with the recognition that other people make mistakes, We are other people too. We make mistakes. We're not enlightened. We're not totally wise and liberated. Our hearts are regularly dominated by greed, hatred, and delusion, by selfish impulses. That's the nature of this life of ours. So we make mistakes. We've said things that are foolish, that are unkind. We've been dishonest. We've been hurtful. Things that we've done have caused difficulty or harm or irritation to others, other people, other creatures. We've caused damage in the world. So in this reflection, again, not to create anxiety or regret, to dwell upon regret and create self-hatred, but to also to acknowledge our own mistakes and to be ready to learn from that and to forgive, to not pretend that that our behavior was actually beautiful and was really good and quite all right, but rather to recognize, no, that was a stupid thing to have said. That was really greedy. That was selfish. That was dishonest. That was unkind. It wasn't beautiful. It was ugly. That was an unskillful thing to have done. But to recognize that and say, okay, well, recognizing that, what's the effect on the heart? How does that feel? So when we bring the attention to that, we realize, ow, it's painful to remember. Okay, it's painful to remember. It's painful to bring that to mind. Let that pain be something that we use to help us to wake up. Let that be something that helps us to learn and that it becomes a motivation to do better in the future. One of the frequent encouragements of the Buddha in the teachings, over and over again, he says to when one of his disciples has done something foolish or destructive or harmful in some way, he says to recognize one's transgression, one's mistake as that, and to endeavor to do better in the future. This is what is called development in this Dhamma and discipline, in this teaching. So he didn't assume that people would never make mistakes. Rather, he assumed that people would make mistakes. Yes, we do make mistakes. But rather than hating ourselves for it on the one hand, or pretending it didn't really happen on the other hand, no, it happened. It was a mistake. But then if we learn from that, then we put that mistake, that the painful results of our actions, we put that to good use. And so that then that painfulness becomes a cause for beneficial action. So in this ending of the year and looking back over this time, to consider where in our behavior have we done things that caused others harm, or that we feel regret, or that we've made mistakes, we said things that were inappropriate or dishonest and such like. To bring that to mind, to recognize that, and to say, okay, that had a painful result. I know I can do better. Okay, so let's recognize that painful result and use that to help guide a pathway forward in the future. Let that be something that helps to clarify what is a good direction. So when we talk about a new year resolution, and the this is a custom in many, many countries around the world, to at the ending of the year, it's in a way looking at the bad habits that we've had, or those unskillful actions, the ways that we've behaved that have been problematic or harmful, or foolish, wasteful, and to set a new resolution. Okay, let's try and do things better in the future. It's based on this same principle. So often we don't like to acknowledge or look at our behavior or think of it as being bad, and we it can become a cause for self-hatred or kind of anxiety, sort of neurotic tendencies. But the Buddha encouraged us to look at that, to not build up self-view around that, to not make it into a neurotic problem, but rather to acknowledge what is wholesome, what's unwholesome, what's skillful, what's unskillful. And to use the painfulness that comes from unskillful action to be a guide, as I've been describing. So this is called hiri otapa in the Pali. Hiri otapa. So you can translate that into English as moral sensitivity. The heart's feeling for what is noble and beautiful and what's harmful and destructive. And that's a great richness. So you might want to think, well, I never want to feel shame. I never want to feel bad about myself. That's like saying, I don't want to have any hiri otapa. But in Buddhist psychology, it has a different perspective. Like, the more spiritually mature you are, the more hiri otapa you have, the more you really care about every tiny action, every word that you say. It's like you become more scrupulous and caring about everything that you do, everything that you say, so that rather than becoming, as you become more free in the heart or more spiritually mature, that you then don't care about your actions and speech. It's the opposite. You care more and more, but that caring isn't a sort of neurotic anxiety. It's more like a thoroughness, like a skilled musician. That someone who's a real, what they call a virtuoso on the piano or the violin, you know, they will notice that when they play a piece of music and the people listening, oh, that's amazing, that's incredible, that was absolutely perfect. They say, no. And the 15th bar, you know, I didn't hold that note quite long enough. It wasn't quite absolutely on the mark. Or like the famous guitarist Segovia, who was the kind of grandfather of the classical guitar, when he was being interviewed and when he was over 90 years old, the interviewer said, "Do you still practice your instrument every day?" And then they described how he kind of blushed and said, "Well, after I turned 90, I have only practiced about 6 hours a day." Sort of like a kind of apologizing for being so lazy. You know, he used to practice at least 9 hours a day every day, but since he turned 90, he'd only did 6 hours a day. Like, sorry, you know. So, but yeah, my fingers get tired, you know. So that kind of care increases, but it's not a neurotic problem, but rather it's showing a real pure and refined attunement of the heart to what is noble and beautiful. So then the fourth of these reflections I like to encourage as the time ticks away. It's now 9:15, so our life is ebbing. The year is ebbing away, eroding away, so getting closer to the end. Is for some people, it's the hardest of these reflections to look at the things that we're resentful or appreciative of in others is one thing, and then looking at our own mistakes, our own shortcomings is another. But the fourth one is to look at the good actions that we have performed, to look at our own good qualities. And so for many of us, that's really difficult because we sometimes assume that to think positive thoughts about ourselves or what we've done, it means we're going to be proud or get inflated or kind of carried away or think that we're going to get lost in the idea. I'm such a wonderful person. People are really lucky to have me around. But this is a quality along with the other reflections that the Buddha liked people to encourage people to do, like to what they call mindfulness of death, Maranānusati, or mindfulness of the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, mindfulness of the Triple Gem, Buddhānusati, Dhammānusati, Sanghānusati, and so on. Another of these contemplations the Buddha encouraged is called Chāgānusati. Chāgānusati. And that chaga literally means wealth. But in this context, what it means is your own spiritual wealth, your own goodness. So chaganusati is to look at your own goodness, to reflect upon your own goodness. And so as the fourth contemplation, and if our life is ebbing away with just a few minutes left to go, to look back and to really acknowledge the good that you have done. How, yeah, you did pay for that person behind you on the bridge. You did get up and give somebody a seat on the tube. Yeah, you did sit patiently while your sister or your brother was weeping their heart out because of failing an exam or their loved one had left them or whatever it might have been, or there was an opportunity to be kind, to be patient, to be generous, and you took it. So this can be very difficult for people because we tend to be, certainly in the West, what they call self-effacing. Oh, no, it wasn't really anything. Well, I didn't really help. Or, yeah, I haven't really done anything worthwhile. Or my life has really been a bit of a waste and I haven't done anything useful. And it's easy for us to think in those patterns and completely overlook the fact that we have been a really kind, generous, thoughtful, compassionate person, and that our presence can be really treasured, can be something that's really important in the lives of people around us, but we sort of brush it aside. It's like, oh, it's nothing, it doesn't really matter, or that's not really worth anything. So chaganusati can be quite challenging, and a way to approach it is, if somebody else had done the actions that you had done, you would be happy to praise them. If somebody else had been sort of kind and compassionate and generous and thoughtful and helpful, you'd say, oh, what a wonderful person. You know, she's really great because she does this, this, and this. But just because it's got your name on it, then you think, oh, no, it wasn't anything. It doesn't really matter. So that way of looking back over this year and in the past and to to acknowledge, oh, that was good. I'm really glad I did that. I'm really glad I helped that person. I'm really glad I did that work. I'm really glad I put my effort and energy into volunteering with this particular charity, or that I wrote that book, or I stayed with that person when they went to the hospital and sat with them through the night. And that was something that was really lovely to do. I'm really glad I did that. And to acknowledge that goodness. So chaganusati is to acknowledge the goodness that you have brought into the world. And again, not to make yourself inflated or conceited or think, oh, I'm so special and the world is blessed to have me around. But to allow that punya, those blessings to be fully acknowledged, to be recognized, that quality of brightness in the heart that comes from good action. Because when we don't acknowledge that, it's rather like working really hard, making a lot of savings, putting it all in the bank and never using the money that you've worked hard to accumulate. You know, you've created all this goodness, you've created all this good karma, but you're not allowing yourself to experience the brightness, the inner beauty that comes from having created that good karma. So again, as the year winds down and we have these hours together, to be reflecting on the good that has been done in your words, in your action, in your attitude, and to consider also the things that you haven't done. Like, you know, you might think, well, I'm a Buddhist, so I don't kill things. You know, I don't take life. I respect life, and so. You might not think of that as anything special, or that, or you don't drink, or that, or Ajahn Amaro was talking about you're not getting drunk on the New Year. Well, I haven't had a drink for 20 years or 30 years, and so we might brush those things aside. But those are significant actions. You know, your choice to not consume alcohol sets a standard for the people around you. They know, oh, she's quite happy without going out and getting drunk. She doesn't need to go and get loaded on the weekend. She's quite happy being the person that she is. She doesn't need to be getting lost in drugs or alcohol in order to feel good. Aha, you can be that way. Or that your respect for life, your respect for honesty, the fact that you don't gossip or you don't lie, you don't cheat people, that's a blessing for the people around you. We can overlook that. We can say it's nothing. But those things have an impact. Many years ago, when we had one of the first community retreats at Chidhurst back in about 1980 or 81, in very early days of Chidhurst, we were about 4 or 5 days into this week-long period of group meditation, and maybe a week or so, and I think Lumpur Zomato was noticing that there was a bit of kind of grim seriousness on our faces, you know, around the room, and all kind of serious meditator expressions on our, and really working hard on our minds. And I think he picked up the sense that we were all looking at our minds and sort of struggling with how many defilements there were, how much lust and fear and aversion and restlessness and dullness and so on. And like, oh, I'm not good, I'm not trying hard enough, I'm not a good meditator, I'm not getting this right, got too many unskillful thoughts. And so one day he gave this reflection, he said, you know, well, we've had this retreat going now for 6 or 7 days, and none of you have killed anybody. That's great. None of you have murdered anyone. That's fantastic. That's a lot better than many people around the world can say. Well done. Well done. You know, and Lumpur, he can be very funny. So he carried that theme on. He said, none of you have stolen anything. That's amazing. You know, 25 men and women living together, and everyone is respecting everybody else's property. You don't even steal each other's seats. You know, you come along and you have your spot where you sit in the, we only had the reception room, in those days, the, uh, what's now the shrine room in the house had a big hole in the floor from the dry rot. So we're all just squished into the reception room in the, at that time. And you're celibate. That's miraculous. Like 25 men and women living together, and none of you, you're not having sex with each other, you're not flirting with each other, you're not touching each other. This is incredible, amazing. Well done. Congratulations. And so, you know, he could kind of ham it up a bit. But by the time he got to sort of the third and fourth precept, he's going, yeah, that's right. That is kind of amazing, really, yeah. And all the things that we weren't doing in terms of behavior, and that you were forgetting that here you had 25 young women and men gathered together, living in this place in the countryside, and living a very restrained and focused life, keeping silence, practicing meditation, sitting and walking meditation all day long. When you looked at it, oh, this is kind of extraordinary that the group of human beings put their, say, act on their skillful intentions and put their hearts into training the mind in this way. Well, yeah, that's quite extraordinary. So in terms of looking at the good effects of our life, don't belittle the things that we don't do. The fact that you don't cheat or you don't lie, you don't take advantage of other people. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. These are not small things. This is a gift to others. And maybe the last thing to share, and in terms of setting New Year resolutions, then one of the most obvious standards to suggest or to encourage is a specific commitment for the lay community to be living by the five precepts. Probably most of you are familiar with these, but this is a standard that the Buddha established as a way to live skillfully, to be a true human being, to be a true manusa. Then the characteristic of a true human being is one who lives according to the precepts, who lives a moral life. So the first one is panatipata, to refrain from taking the life of other living beings. Second one is adinadana, to refrain from stealing, not taking what is not given to you. The third one is to refrain from sexual misconduct, kamesu michachara. The fourth one is to refrain from lying, so honesty in our speech, musawada. And then the fifth one is to refrain from using alcohol and drugs that bring heedlessness. So I would suggest, if you want to set a direction for the coming year, you want to make a resolution. Again, I'm not reading anybody's mind. I don't know how your behavior has been. But if there have been times when you have been less than honest in your speech, or you have had a few drinks, or you have murdered a few green fly in your garden and such like, then to be looking at the standard of keeping the five precepts in a rigorous and sincere way is not just a blessing for you, but that's also a blessing for the green fly in your garden, the people that you live with, the people in your family, the people that you work with, the people on the street, the people that you share your life with. The Buddha called the five precepts, he said these are not just limitations on our behavior, but they're also what he called the five mahadana, the five great gifts. And we don't always think of the precepts as a gift or something that is given, but the point he made in using this language was to say, when you say determined to not take the life of other living beings, then you give the gift of fearlessness to other beings, that you give limitless freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, yeah, freedom from distress to uncountable living beings. And in turn, you bring freedom from fear, freedom from anxiety, freedom from distress to yourself. So it's helpful to think of the five precepts as the five great gifts that you're giving fearlessness. People don't have to be afraid that you're going to rip them off. You're going to steal things from you, from them. You're not going to cheat them. When you come into the room, people don't put the handbag under their chair. You know, or kind of make, if you're going to come and visit, they don't have to lock the cupboards because you know, fear that you're going to help yourself to some of their things around the home. They know you're not going to lie to them. You're not going to cheat them. You're not going to deceive them. What a relief. So that's a gift of fearlessness, abhaya dana, and that's what comes as a natural result of living by the five precepts. And as the Buddha said also, that this is what makes us truly human, to really live in the manusa loka, the human realm. That's defined by one who lives a life guided by the moral precepts. So the hour has gone by. It's now 9:30, and so I'll finish my reflections here. People are warmly invited to spend the rest of the evening cultivating loving kindness and to be reflecting on these themes. And then at 11:30, in a couple of hours' time, then we'll chant the Purita and bring the new year in. Everyone.